Good day. Today is Tuesday, 7th October 2025, and may I first begin this video by saying again what I said in my video yesterday, which is please tick the like button to this video if after watching the video or however much of the video you want to watch, you've liked the video and want to indicate that fact. So, having said that, let's move on to the situation that is playing out in the world today, and let us begin with France, because it seems to me that the most interesting and important fact of the last 24 hours in the political crisis in France is that Macron's authority is beginning to drain away. Now, firstly, after the resignation of his latest choice for Prime Minister, his former political ally, Sébastien Lecornu, though I'm beginning to get the impression that Lecornu, like many others, is now starting to turn against his patron, Macron. Anyway, after the sudden announcement that Lecornu was unable to form a government and was intending to resign, Macron came back and told him that he should stay on for 48 hours and see whether or not he can come to some kind of understanding or consensus with the political leaders in the French Parliament in order, as Macron says, to chart a way forward and to restore stability. What will happen after those 48 hours, if Lecornu is unsuccessful, Macron, of course, did not make clear. Many took it as a hint that he intends to call parliamentary elections, perhaps, but we shall have to wait and see because, as I said, he didn't make it clear. Lecornu has shown little enthusiasm in carrying out this instruction. He's made it absolutely clear that even if his various talks with the political parties are successful, he himself does not intend to remain Prime Minister. So he's going anyway. But anyway, he's received his orders from Macron. So he's going through the motions as I'm making this programme, presumably of consulting various political forces in the French Parliament and perhaps outside it to see whether some way through, as Macron puts it, can be found. Now, the way through is staring everybody in the face and more people are saying it. Firstly, Marine Le Pen has now said that the time has come for Macron to do that which, frankly, he should have done weeks ago or months ago, which is dissolve the French National Assembly and call new parliamentary elections. As Le Pen undoubtedly correctly says, this is the moment to ask the people of France what they think and follow their guidance as the way through the political crisis. But it is still not the solution, obviously, that Macron himself wants to adopt. Meanwhile, his government, if we can call it that, continues to dissolve. Bruno Le Maire, another of Macron's allies, if I can speak in those terms. Anyway, he was going to be apparently appointed defense minister in succession to Sébastien Lecornu. Bruno Le Maire is somebody, incidentally, who is well known in Russia because way back in February 2022, after the sanctions, the first massive wave of sanctions, the sanctions which resulted in the freezing of the assets of the Russian Central Bank. Anyway, when those sanctions were imposed, Le Maire gave an interview, I think it was on French radio, in which he said quite openly that the intention was to completely collapse, to destroy, I believe was his word, choice of words, the Russian economy. Well, as we see, it has turned out otherwise. Anyway, Le Maire, like Le Cornu, is a close political ally and friend of Macron for reasons which I do not know myself, because obviously I'm not in France and I don't follow French politics with a level of detail that I once did. Anyway, Le Maire is unacceptable to other members of the French cabinet, such as it is. They were apparently shocked and horrified when they discovered that Bruno Le Maire was being appointed defence minister and started to complain and raise objections. And within about an hour, Le Maire followed the example of Le Cornu and announced his resignation. Another key official, in other words, Le Maire, as well as Le Cornu, is now bailing out of the sinking boat, which is Emmanuel Macron. Well, things have continued over the course of yesterday, and for the first time now, we are having calls from increasing numbers of people, including former political allies of Macron, like Edouard Philippe, who was Macron's first prime minister. He is now calling on Macron to resign. And Gabriel Attal, who was the other prime minister of France, the one who was prime minister at a time when Macron decided, without consulting Attal or anyone else, to dissolve the French parliament last year. Anyway, he apparently is hinting that Macron should resign also. So we see that support for Macron is draining away and that calls for him to go are growing. And, well, where we are concerned with Philippe, I will briefly read that which the Financial Times says. Speaking a day after the collapse of the fourth government since Macron called snap elections last year, former Prime Minister Edouard Philippe urged the President to bring forward the presidential contest scheduled for 2027. France needs to emerge in an orderly and dignified manner from a political crisis that is harming the country. Another 18 months of this is far too long. There is a terrible risk that new parliamentary elections will also not lead to a majority, prolonging the country's political crisis. Well, there we are. So demands now starting to crystallise, calling for Macron to step down. Now, Macron, as we know, is somebody who's going to be very averse to stepping down, quite apart from the fact that he doesn't want to give up power. Politicians rarely do. Quite apart from the fact that he still has a personal agenda that he wants to implement. His ideas for a coalition of the willing to send troops to Ukraine. His plans to impose further sanctions on the Russians. His further plans, perhaps, to seize ships that trade with Russia on the high seas. All of those things that we've discussed in many programmes. But overall, and beyond that, there is, of course, his own desire to continue to push forward with the programme of European integration. More Europe, as he always and repeatedly says. And, of course, he also wants to create the conditions so that when he does leave the presidency, someone from the National Rally is not going to be elected his successor. So Macron has certain real political reasons for wanting to stay. But beyond that, there is the other factor that one should not overlook, and that is his immense vanity. The idea that he will be the first president since the creation by Charles de Gaulle of the Fifth Republic, the first president of France to be elected by direct elections by the French people, who has been forced to step down before the expiry of his term. That would, for Macron, be an almost unbearable humiliation, given the inordinately high opinion he has of himself and of his colossal abilities. Jupiter, whom he has compared himself to, the head of the Roman gods and the biggest planet in the solar system, Jupiter is not someone who is at the beck and call of others, mere mortals in the political constellation, as Macron must see it. So he is, for the first couple of days, I am confident, going to resist this as much as he can. Probably he will call parliamentary elections, and nonetheless, and in spite of that, I suspect he will try to cling on, and I further suspect that he will do all of the things that I discussed in my programme yesterday, and which I very much wish he would not do, which is try to cobble together electoral coalitions, engage in further electoral manipulations, do everything he possibly can to prevent the National Rally from winning. Now, I say that, I know that there is an alternative view that exists. I read an article in the British media, I think it was The Telegraph, that suggested that Macron's game plan might be to call parliamentary elections, assume that the National Rally wins, allow the National Rally to form a government, and then let the National Rally government fail because of its inability to deal with the enormous, intractable problems of France, and then look forward to the pendulum swing, which will shift politics back in a centrist direction at the time of the next presidential elections in 2027. I don't think this is what Macron himself will do. For one thing, I think he probably realises that if the National Rally wins the next parliamentary elections, if they emerge with a majority, the one thing that they're going to insist upon is that Macron step down. They will say that, yes, we do want to govern, but we cannot govern effectively whilst Macron remains in the Élysée. And since France needs a government, and since Macron has no popularity in France, the time has come for him to go. And, well, I don't want to foresee things too far ahead. And, of course, there's always individual aspects of French politics that are difficult to always gauge if you are an outsider. I suspect that that will be a compelling argument. If the National Rally fails to gain a majority in the parliamentary elections, if it emerges as the biggest party, but parties of the left also emerge as, well, maybe not winners, but as players in the French Parliament, then I suspect the demands for Macron to go will be still greater. And this time, they will come from the left as well as from the right. People will say Macron's policies have brought about the situation where the National Rally is now the biggest party in the French Parliament, where it is on the brink of forming a government. The longer Macron stays, the stronger the National Rally becomes. The time has come for him to go, so that a candidate of the left can convincingly take on the National Rally in the parliamentary elections, the presidential elections, and stop them in their track before they gain political dominance. So one way or the other, I think if there are parliamentary elections, I think the likelihood is that we will start to see the fading away and then the eventual humiliating end of Emmanuel Macron. He will try to cling on as long as he can. As I said, quite apart from anything else, his incredible vanity, all-consuming vanity, which has been his downfall, will not let him, will not allow him to go quietly. But eventually, if everybody, if the entire political class, or at least the functional parts of the political class, demand that he leave to the point where it becomes impossible to form any sort of government, even to find a prime minister, a political leader, who would be prepared to serve as prime minister under him, well, at that point, Macron, presumably, will find it impossible and will find it impossible to cling on and stay. So I suspect, obviously, there's always uncertainties and things might go in all sorts of strange directions. But as things stand, given the way that Macron has obliterated normal politics in France, destabilised the situation entirely, given the depth of his isolation, I cannot see how for very much longer, whatever happens over the next few weeks or months, I cannot see how he can remain president of France for very much longer. Well, perhaps given that, it might be worth taking a step back and asking what might happen if there are presidential elections in France at some point over the next few months. Again, the most likely winner, as things stand, would presumably be someone from the National Rally. Marine Le Pen, if she can overcome the legal obstacles that have been created in order to prevent her standing for the presidency, or perhaps the impossibly young Joseph Bardella, who is all of 30 years old, but who does seem to be a popular personality in France, though personally I would be extremely nervous of electing such a very young man to the French presidency. After all, Macron was in his 30s when he became president of France. And as we see, it all went to his head. And we see what the outcome of that was. Anyway, let's assume that it is someone from the National Rally. Now, I think a number of things then happen. And I am going to focus now on the international relations aspect, the geopolitics aspect, rather than the domestic one, about which I am less confident in things that I can say. Firstly, it's perhaps worth saying that in the European Parliament at the present time, there is a motion of no confidence against the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. And it is being backed within the European Parliament by the French National Rally. Indeed, I believe that one of the people who has participated in the debates in the European Parliament and who is calling for the vote of no confidence in Ursula to succeed is none other than Joseph Bardella. So it seems to me that if the National Rally wins power in France, Ursula has in Paris, one of the capital of one of the two great powers within the European Union, the other is of course Germany. Ursula has in Paris a government that is openly hostile to her. She also, incidentally, has a government in Berlin whose leader, Friedrich Merz, makes little secret that he doesn't like her. But I'm not going to debate or discuss that in this program. So already that is going to cause Ursula lots of problems. And I find it very difficult, given all the National Rally have been saying for the last couple of years, that they would want to continue the program of providing endless financial, economic and military support for Ukraine. One thing which I am confident they would not want to do is continue with Macron's coalition of the willing enterprise. Ever since the fall of Avdiivka in February 2024, Macron has been agitating in one form or another to send French troops to Ukraine. He's tried to get them to be sent to Ukraine as some kind of force to reinforce the Ukrainian army, to allow the Ukrainians, as he put it, to redeploy from their borders and other places their forces so that they can take on the Russians in the front lines. That was his original rationale. The Americans and the other Europeans were not keen on that idea at all. The Americans, and we're now talking about the Biden administration, made it absolutely clear that they did not agree in any way with this plan, because they knew perfectly well that if Macron did insert the French army into Ukraine, the Russians would be certain to attack it, and Macron at that point would be running off to Washington and demanding that the Americans come to his rescue. So that particular idea was stillborn. But then Donald Trump was elected and Macron came up with a plan all over again. And this time he found in the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, a willing accomplice. So no longer was it just a plan to send French troops to Ukraine. Now it was a plan to send a reassurance force composed mostly of French troops to Ukraine. And it was always said that this would have to be done in the context of a ceasefire, which meant, in effect, with Russian permission. But Macron, being Macron, many times pushed back on that. He said that the Russians had no veto on the matter, that it was entirely, in the end, a matter between Europe and Ukraine, France and Britain and Ukraine. If there was a ceasefire and the Ukrainians asked for the French and British troops to go into Ukraine, the Russians had no right to make any objections. I pointed out many times that this was a fatuous argument. Sending French and British troops into trouble, and that if it were pursued to its logical end, well, what it meant would be that the Russians, knowing that if they did agree to a ceasefire in the conflict in Ukraine, would be facing NATO forces in Western Ukraine. They would never, in those kind of circumstances, agree to a ceasefire. And that is exactly, of course, how it has played out. In reality, Macron's plan to send a reassurance force into Ukraine was exactly the same plan as his earlier plan to send a French force into Ukraine whilst the fighting was still underway. In both cases, it was intended to draw the United States into the conflict in Ukraine, directly into the conflict in Ukraine, and set up conditions for a direct clash between the United States and Russia. And for the proof of that, look no further than the unending ceaseless attempts that Macron and Starmer have pursued since Trump's election to try to get him to agree to a backstop for these French and British troops that Macron wants to send to Ukraine. Donald Trump has never provided that backstop, which is why for the moment the idea again seems to be dead. But of course, so long as Macron remains in the Elysee, there is always the risk that at some moment he will revive it, and then possibly he might find takers both in Europe and conceivably within the United States, including, there's always this risk, Donald Trump himself. Well, French opinion is opposed to this. The National Rally is strongly opposed to this. So, by the way, is the left. If there is an election, a presidential election, if there is a new president, either from the National Rally or presumably from the left, then I think this idea probably is finally dead. The coalition of the willing, this whole project, will have gone, and hopefully gone for good. Its original begetter, Emmanuel Macron, will have departed from the scene, and I cannot imagine any successor, either from the right, from the National Rally, or from the left, wanting to embrace this particular plan. Now, going beyond this, it's very much more difficult to say what would happen. The National Rally, Marine Le Pen, have at various times dropped hints that they might not support the sanctions policy against Russia. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, on the left, has, if anything, been even more forthright about this. They've both, on the National Rally and on the left, at times wanted to give the impression that they would indeed want to find some kind of way back with Russia, and that they might resume some kind of serious diplomatic engagement with the Russian government. I have to say that here, I am not sure that we will see that sort of movement. I suspect that the National Rally, like Macron, or the left, like Macron, would be hostile or averse to the idea of confiscating the Russian assets, though Macron can never be trusted on this. And, well, I'm not sure to what extent either the National Rally or the left can be either, to be frank. About sanctions, re-engagement with Russia, that would go so far out against the current prevailing European orthodoxies. It might be so strongly opposed by the Merz government in Berlin that I am not sure that any French government, even one from the National Rally or from the left, would want to go there. Nonetheless, if there is a government, if there is a president drawn from the National Rally, Marine Le Pen or Joseph Bardella or someone from the left, someone connected to Jean-Luc Mélenchon, or perhaps even Mélenchon himself, then I think we probably will see a change, but it will be limited to those things that I've discussed. The coalition of the willing idea will probably be dead. The idea of sending French troops to Ukraine, unpopular with many people in France, most people in France, would probably also be dead. It's unlikely, to put it mildly, that they would go down the pathway of seizing ships in the high seas, as Macron has talked about. But whether they would be prepared to go beyond that, whether they would take serious steps to try to repair relations, to try to bring a serious peace to Europe, that, of course, very much remains to be seen. Anyway, there it is. If this coalition of the willing idea is once and for all and finally buried, that would be a very good thing in itself. And in terms of securing peace in Europe, and by the way, perhaps concentrating minds in Europe eventually on how to bring an end to Project Ukraine and restore peace to Europe, it would in itself be a step forward, a significant step forward. But I think it would be unwise to expect a rapid rapprochement. Anyway, that's what I want to say about this. Of course, Macron is still in the Elysee. He probably still has, or thinks he has, tricks up his sleeve. But I do get the sense, and obviously I'm watching events from a distance, that his authority and his credibility and his ability to continue to function as French president is now rapidly draining away. He is the arch disruptor of French politics. He cannot be counted out until he finally is out. But I get the sense that even the political class, even the centrists now, as well, of course, as the wider French public, have finally lost patience and are exasperated with him and are telling him that it is time for him to go. For the record, if he does go, if he announces tomorrow that he is leaving the presidency, not something, by the way, that I expect, but who knows? Macron always makes his own decisions. If he does that, well, I have the champagne waiting. That's all I'm going to say about that. Anyway, that's Macron, that's France. It's perhaps worth saying at this point that the political situation across the rest of Europe remains incredibly bleak. If we're talking about Britain, it's an almost overlooked fact that the Conservative Party, what was the governing party of Britain until June last year, the party that has dominated British politics for the last 200 years, the party of Thatcher and Churchill and Disraeli and Salisbury, who knows whom else, Wellington. Anyway, that party is now holding its annual conference, and it is astonishing to see the complete indifference and lack of interest in it. I've seen pictures of the hall in which this conference is being held, which is in the city of Manchester, by the way, and the Shadow Chancellor, a personality who I confess is almost completely unknown to me. He's been plucked out of nowhere. His name is Mel. Anyway, he delivered a speech, and the hall was two-thirds empty. At least that's what the pictures suggested. Hardly any conservatives are coming. The contrast with the days of Margaret Thatcher, when, well, whatever you thought of the conservatives then, whatever you thought of Thatcher then, the place was humming with energy and electricity, where the halls were full and the speeches were listened to and people were constantly wanting to hear what every minister or shadow minister or official might be saying and trying to understand the direction of events within the Conservative Party. Anyway, that time, which I so well remember, and what I saw in this conference hall in Manchester, the contrast could not be more stark. It really does look as if the Conservative Party is gradually, if not gradually, rapidly fading away. And, well, I don't think the Labour Party is in much better shape, just saying. And, of course, there are other political forces developing in Britain. Farage and his group, Reform, his party, Reform, which seem to be, for the moment at least, in the ascendant, have some similarities to Le Pen and the National Rally in France. I think they're closer to each other, by the way, than either of them is to the AfD in Germany, just saying. But anyway, you can see that just as traditional politics in France have been hollowed out and are now in showing clear signs of collapse, the same is true in Britain. And in Germany, of course, Friedrich Merz is now about to unleash his massive debt-fueled binge. I don't know anybody in Germany who seriously believes that it's going to improve the situation, the underlying situation in Germany at all. But anyway, there again, the AfD is now apparently established as the most popular party in Germany. It's dipped upwards, it's gone upwards and downwards. Sometimes the CDU has drawn just ahead, but other times the CDU has fallen back. There's a very interesting article in the Telegraph about the deep unpopularity of the CDU and of the Chancellor Friedrich Merz in the northern town, the northern West German town of Lübeck, for example. Anyway, I don't think things there are much better. And of course, deindustrialization and hollowing out in Germany continues as well. So this malaise that we see in France is repeated right across Europe. But the personality of Emmanuel Macron and certain aspects of French national tradition and French politics, of course, give it its individual twist. I would just add here a personal comment, which is that one of the difficulties I have talking about Emmanuel Macron is that, as with Justin Trudeau and today Keir Starmer, he embodies a type of post-politics which I especially loathe. Macron, Trudeau, Starmer never have been much interested in governing their countries in any kind of conventional sense. They basically, what they do, and this is true of leaders across much of the West, and especially in Europe, is that they occupy the political space where once upon a time, politics, as I remembered it, used to happen. And by occupying that space, they prevent others who might engage in actual politics from filling that space and doing something that might be meaningful for the people of the countries which they pretend they lead. And, well, perhaps I shouldn't say more than that, at least not in this programme. But, frankly, if Macron goes and all of the others go, then good riddance as far as I'm concerned. Now, there are some real leaders in Europe still left. Viktor Orban of Hungary is one. Again, I'm not somebody who necessarily agrees or often agrees with many of the things he does, but that he does actually have drive and energy and purpose that is indisputable. And when Alex and I visited Hungary last year, one of the things we were told was that Orban is a workaholic. He is busy doing things continuously all the time. There is no aspect of Hungarian governance that he isn't personally and directly and continually engaged in. Anyway, he's made a number of further comments over the last few hours. He said that that Hungary has no plan to join the euro. And he also said that Hungary has no interest in joining the euro because it is a project of a European Union that is now collapsing. Well, I'm not sure that he's right about that. I think it's still got some way to go. But anyway, that is Orban's view. And I suspect it was partly shaped by his recent experience at the summit meeting in Copenhagen. Now, I discussed that summit meeting at length in a recent program, and I discussed the extraordinary, belligerent, confrontational, fantastical language that came out of that meeting, with people talking about Europe being in effect in a kind of war with Russia. But note that absolutely nothing has happened since. There's been no announcement yet about Russian assets being confiscated. I read a scathing piece in the rather right-wing British magazine Spiked about, well, mostly the drone war. It talked about how the European drone war was a preposterous idea because Europe doesn't actually make drones. If it wanted to make drones, or if it wanted to create a drone war, it would have to buy them from China, which of course isn't going to happen. And besides, we're looking at a 5,000 kilometre border, which is far too long to be patrolled and guarded in the way that people say, with the resources that the European Union can actually bring to bear. And of course, there's much talk about rearming Ukraine. Spite was incredibly scathing about that. Also said that the Europeans don't produce weapons. They can't afford to buy from the United States the weapons that the United States does still produce. And of course, the United States itself doesn't produce weapons on the scale and of the magnitude that it once did. So anyway, those are the European leaders. Orban saw them in action. He saw Macron in action, as well as Ursula, and his view is that the whole thing is collapsing. There is, of course, one leader who occupies what until very recently also used to be thought of as a European country, European in the geographical and cultural sense. And he seems very much in control and fully in charge of things and has energy and the power of decision and all of those things. That leader is, of course, Vladimir Putin, who, by the way, and just for the record, celebrates his 73rd birthday today. Now, that brings me back, of course, to the perennial topic of these programmes, which is the conflict in Ukraine. And Donald Trump has again made comments about the Tomahawk missiles. He was asked about them by a journalist, and he replied in ways that are either ominous or not, depending on how you interpret them. He said that before he provides Ukraine with Tomahawks, he wants the Ukrainians first to explain to him what they intend to do with them. Now, that implies that the Ukrainians have not told him what they intend to do with them. But, of course, they have. They've said it at considerable length. They want to conduct missile strikes against Moscow. Zelensky has talked about Russian officials needing to take cover and remain close to their bunkers, because the Ukrainians clearly have, amongst other things, some plans for decapitation strikes against the leadership in Moscow, and presumably that is what they want the Tomahawk missiles for. And of course, the Ukrainians, with American encouragement, have been conducting a drone war against Russian oil refineries. I've discussed this at great length in recent programs. Just to say, I've said that it isn't achieving anything like the success that some people in the West believe that it is. For the record, this Ukrainian offensive against the Russian oil refineries, it reminds me a little of the Ukrainian offensive against the Russian Black Sea Fleet. There continues to be a narrative that this was some great success. I pointed out that, in fact, it has done little damage to the Russian Black Sea Fleet, and claims that it has prevented the Russian Black Sea Fleet from being used to blockade Crimea's Black Sea coast is simply wrong. That the Russians could have done that at any time using missiles, long-range missiles, of which they have no shortage, or drones, which they now have in massive abundance, to attack ships that trade with Ukraine. Or they could have laid minefields, or they could have used their submarines to impose that kind of blockade if they'd wanted to. The Russians chose not to, though it's clear to me that they did at least give thought to the idea, because they found that their friends in the global south were strongly opposed, because their friends in the global south want to continue to receive Ukrainian food and grain exports. And the Russians made the entirely correct political decision that a blockade of the Ukrainian coastline would not compensate, the gains to be gained from that would not compensate for the massive loss of goodwill from the global south if they conducted a blockade of that kind. But, well, you can always play up the story, you can always make it, write articles about Ukraine's tremendous success with underwater drones in the Black Sea, and disregard, as I said, the limited actual impact that this drone offensive has had. And it makes for an attractive narrative and gives something to the journalists in the West to write about. And it seems to me that Ukraine is doing almost exactly the same thing with its drone offensive against Russian oil refineries. It makes for a story that excited people and the British and American media can comment upon and write about, disregarding its complete, its large-scale ineffectiveness. But anyway, it's again quite obvious that if Zelensky were provided with Tomahawk missiles, he would try to attack the Russian oil refineries. He's made little secret of it, with those missiles. And he would also try to attack Russian bases and Russian headquarters and all of those things. So when Trump says that he doesn't know what Zelensky's going to do with these Tomahawks, well, he can't be telling the truth. I mean, I have to say that. But then Trump went on to say that though he hasn't made a decision yet, he doesn't want to escalate. He doesn't want to do anything that will escalate the war. And again, supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine is, of course, going to escalate the war. As has been pointed out now by a number of people, supplying the Tomahawk missiles and engaging in deep strikes against Russia would also entirely contradict things that Donald Trump said after the US election, but before he was actually inaugurated in various speech, in an interview, which he gave, I think from memory, it was to Time magazine. He spoke about how he was vehemently against the idea of missile strikes deep inside Russia, which, of course, the Biden administration was at that time conducting with ATACMS missiles. He said that he couldn't see what purpose doing that served. And he also said that doing it would be very reckless, all of which, of course, is true. And perhaps Donald Trump would benefit from listening to himself or rereading what he said. I believe it was to Time magazine all those many months ago. Because, of course, ATACMS missiles are relatively short-range, medium-range missiles. Tomahawk missiles are strategic weapons. They are far more powerful. And, well, they would escalate the war much further than the ATACMS missiles would. And, well, Putin has already said some of the things that supplying the Tomahawks might result in. Anyway, my overall take is that Donald Trump is probably leaning against the decision to supply the Tomahawk missiles when he says that he's not sure what the Ukrainians are going to do with these missiles, and when he says that he doesn't want to escalate the war, he doesn't want to come out straightforwardly and say that he's not going to supply the missiles, because he sort of doesn't, but he's actually setting out reasons why supplying the Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine might not be such a good idea. But with Donald Trump, you can never be sure, and it's possible that he will nonetheless end up making what I have absolutely no doubt at all would be a catastrophically bad decision. The worst decision he has made in his presidency up to now, both his presidencies, both his first one and this one, which is to try to find some way to supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. Anyway, let's move on and let's discuss what's actually going on in the war. The Russians continue and continued overnight to conduct more drone and missile strikes against Ukraine. The attacks were on a slightly lesser scale last night than on previous nights, but this is now an ongoing, continuous offensive, and I suspect that it will continue right up until the end of the year and perhaps beyond. If the Russians really are going to start building 1,000 Garand drones a day, as the Ukrainians, by the way, have said, then there is nothing to stop them conducting an offensive of this kind. And it's become increasingly clear that neither the Ukrainians nor the West has any mechanism, any means to respond to this drone offensive. I'm going to say this, The Russians, well, I don't know what they planned when they decided to buy Garand drones, the original Garand drones, the Shahids from Iran, and then decided to set up the factory to build them. But whoever it was who made that decision, whoever it was in Moscow who thought of that, has revolutionized air war. And that person perhaps one day will come forward from the shadows and we will know who he is. I say that he's revolutionized air war because we see what a drone offensive conducted on this scale can do. And I doubt that anyone else back in 2022 had thought of it, including, by the way, the Iranians themselves. Anyway, that's the first thing to say. The Russians, as I said, continued their missile and drone offensive. And perhaps the most dramatic news came from the battlefronts yesterday from two particular sectors. The Zaporozhye sector, where it looks as if the Russians have now broken through the Ukrainian defences in the Uspenivka and Poltavka fortified villages area. It looks as if Ukrainian defences there are unusually weak, and that when the Ukrainians do try to throw up a defence line, it cannot be held for very long. But perhaps even more catastrophic for the Ukrainians, but also for their military chief, General Sirsky, is what is now playing out in Pokrovsk and northeast of Pokrovsk. Well, first of all, we've had a cascade of news from inside Pokrovsk itself, and it looks as if Ukrainian defences in southeastern Pokrovsk have indeed collapsed, and that the Russians are maybe not in full control of all the high-rise micro-districts there, the Shakhtarsky micro-district and the others. But it looks as if the point of achieving that is almost at that point of being reached. So that is enormously important. It's dramatic news. There's also news that the Russians have indeed broken in to the industrial district northwest of Pokrovsk. And again, it seems that Ukrainian resistance there, up to now at least, has not been as strong as perhaps had been expected. But perhaps for Sirsky himself, the real disaster is playing out in northeastern, the area northeast of Pokrovsk, in the area of the Russian breakthrough, because Sirsky has repeatedly been telling everybody for the last 6 weeks that the Ukrainians there have the Russians up against the ropes, that the Ukrainians have created cauldrons and trapped Russian troops in various places, that they've encircled the Russians, that this entire area of breakthrough is going to be recaptured by the Ukrainians, that the Russians overextended themselves there, and that Ukraine was on the brink of some great victory. Well, as I've been making fairly clear for some time, I've been sceptical of this story. And, well, now it is visibly falling apart, because both at the western side of this area of breakthrough and on the eastern side, it looks as if it's the Russians who are once again on the attack. It looks as if they've re-entered the village of Vladimirovka and that they're seeking to expand their positions to the west also. Now, this is a crisis for the Ukrainians. I've already said many times, if they lose Pokrovsk and if the Russians are able to hold on to this breakthrough area northeast of Pokrovsk, then we are very close to the moment when Konstantinivka, the next big city in this row of dominoes, looks like it's about to be encircled. Anyway, for Ukraine, it is a disaster. But I do wonder what it is going to do for Syrsky himself. Now, maybe I shouldn't be wasting too much time on this, but though I never thought very much, and I have to say this, of Syrsky's predecessor, General Zelushny, who it seemed to me was fundamentally a weak commander, who was always aware that Zelensky's orders to hold positions and to attack was a mistake, but who always and invariably then went ahead and carried out those orders, even as simultaneously he was briefing his friends in telegram channels like Legitimi and Resident about what an irrational and idiotic leader Zelensky was. Anyway, though Zelensky impressed me as a weak and overrated commander, I think it's now become absolutely clear that Syrsky's worse. He too, it seems, cannot stand up to Zelensky. Zelensky's always demanding that positions be held right down to the last millimetre, right down to the last man. Zelensky also always demands attacks in all sorts of places where it makes no sense at all. We had the disastrous Kursk operation of last year. We've had attacks in other places, in Toretsk earlier this year, in this area of the breakthrough. And whereas at least Zelensky went through the motions of pushing back against this, Syrsky not only carries out these attacks that Zelensky is constantly pressing him to do, but then, and I'm afraid there's no easier, better words to use, he lies about the results. He pretends that things are going according to plan, and perhaps here we should say Zelensky's plan. He makes it out that things are either under control or getting better, when in every case they are not. I still remember how, at the time when the Russians were storming Suja in Kursk region, Syrsky came out and denied that this was the case and insisted that the Ukrainians had the situation in Suja completely under control. And of course, by the following day, Suja was in fact entirely under Russian control. Well, that was already very bad, and you could see Syrsky doing the same in other places. But this counterattack that he has organized, these succession of counterattacks that he has organized northeast of Pokrovsk, well, they were probably misconceived in themselves. But what was much, much worse is that Syrsky has been deceiving people, the Ukrainian public, Western governments, and I strongly suspect Zelensky himself, by pretending that these counterattacks were succeeding, whereas in reality they were disastrously failing. Now, Syrsky has been very loyal to Zelensky. Zelensky has never suspected Syrsky's loyalty in the way that Zelensky obviously had doubts about Zelensky's loyalty. So perhaps, and in spite of everything, Zelensky will stick by Syrsky. But I have to say, if so, then, well, Ukraine has an even bigger problem on its hands, because it has as its military chief somebody who is a general who is not only weak and incompetent in questions of command, but dishonest as well. Anyway, let's move on and discuss what's going on in other places, because it's not just in Pokrovsk that the situation for Ukraine is becoming particularly dangerous. There's much talk that the military situation in Siversk is collapsing. And as I said, I spoke about the breakthroughs in Zaporozhye. I noticed that over the course of the last couple of days, there has been complete radio silence, both from the Russians and from the Ukrainians, about the situation in Kupiansk, which strongly suggests to me that that battle is in its final agonizing moments. The Russians are presumably undertaking some kind of operation in Kupiansk that they don't want the world to know about. And the Ukrainians presumably also don't want the world to know about what is happening in Kupiansk, because it is turning out to be a disaster for them. Just saying. Anyway, so the war goes on. Now, always in every discussion of the war, there is the question of who planned what and what the ultimate strategies of the Russian military were, and whether the plan, rather whether the events that we have seen play out on the battlefronts in Ukraine actually do reflect an actual battle plan that the Russian general staff has, and or whether, on the contrary, it's just a case of the Russians improvising, making it up as they go along, taking various steps based on their assessment of Ukrainian weakness in any particular place or location. Well, I've just read a piece, and this has convinced me that, in fact, the Russians are actually working according to a carefully prepared plan, one that was decided by the Russian general staff, and one which has been consistently implemented since roughly March, since the end, in other words, of Ukraine's Kursk enclave, and which is not only going mostly according to plan, but perhaps even more surprisingly, is going according to timetable. Now, recently, via Larry Johnson's indispensable blog, Sona 21, I found that there is also a Substack blog by Marat Khairulin, who is, in my opinion, the best military journalist covering the war on any side, though of course he is on the Russian side. And may I quickly add that there are some Ukrainian journalists covering the war, or bloggers, or war reporters if you prefer, who are also outstanding. Taragami, for example. Doesn't mean I always agree with their assessments or their perspectives, but this has been a very well reported and analysed and commented about war by the war reporters on both sides. Well, Marat Khairulin's Substack is not just by Marat Khairulin. He also has guests, guest writers, one of which is a person I have come across in the past called Zindanov. He used to work, I remember, for Slavyangrad, but he now appears to be working more closely for Marat, with Marat Khairullin. And I came across a piece which Khairullin himself wrote in March, providing a summary of the situation, and the dates appear to be, well, the date is 20th March 2025, and translated by Zindanov. And it is actually entirely remarkable, because though it is written in March, it basically sets out in a surprising degree of detail the exact progress of the Russians that has taken place since then. It describes almost exactly what the Russians were going to do. So it is written just before the Ukrainians were finally and completely driven out of Kursk region. It says that the Russians, however, are unlikely to conduct an advance in depth in Sumy region, and it explains why. It says that the Russians, however, probably at some point will conduct a bigger and wider operation in Kharkiv region and will try to establish what Khairullin refers to as security zone in the Volchansk, Veliki Burluk, Kupiansk area. And that is exactly what is happening. The Russians are wrapping up the fighting in Volchansk, and they appear to be, as I said, in the brink of wrapping up the fighting in Kupiansk. And Veliki Burluk lies almost exactly between Volchansk and Kupiansk, and it does look as if the Russians, and in fact the general staff of the Russian military, all but confirmed that the Russians are indeed in the process of establishing a security zone encompassing this entire area and perhaps ultimately threatening the city of Kharkiv itself. Then we have a detailed account here of the kind of action that the Russians might take in the Siversk and Liman area, and the priority that should be given to Siversk and Liman. The article explains that Siversk is part of a major defense line or complex that the Ukrainians created, which brought together Bakhmut, Toretsk, and Solidar, and that this territory, this cluster of towns, is the major barrier towards the final defense line, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, and Konstantinovka, and that Siversk is now the last town in that complex, that barrier that needs to be taken. And he discusses very accurately, actually, how it might be taken. He also discusses how, if the Russians might capture Kupiansk, they could push south towards Izium again, which is precisely what they seem to be doing. He speaks about the importance of Chasiv Yar, and he says this is the last fortress of the Ukrainians covering Konstantinovka and Kramatorsk, which is currently the capital of the occupied part of the Donetsk People's Republic. When the main heights near Chasiv Yar are under our control, we will be able to advance to Kramatorsk and the road connecting it to Konstantinovka, which is again exactly what, according to the Russian general staff, they're doing. And then there is a section which, quite frankly, took my breath away. It says this, that once basically Toretsk is cleared, the Russian armed forces will likely move from the Vozdvizhenka area. Vozdvizhenka is the village located to the south of the main supply road between Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka. Anyway, the Russian armed forces will likely move from the Vozdvizhenka area to bypass Pokrovsk, cutting off the supply route through Rodinska, which is, again, exactly what the Russians have done. And then looking forward, Khairulin talks about a Russian advance and referencing in the south towards Zaporozhye and Dnipro. He speaks about the enormous importance of Dnipro in particular. He says that once Dnipro itself is surrounded, one of the steps the Russians will take will be to destroy the Dnieper bridges, and that is the right moment to do it. And he says the main direction will be the encirclement of Dnipro. He calls it Dniepropetrovsk. The city itself does not need to be taken physically. As I mentioned earlier, it can be blockaded by destroying the bridges. This would not require large forces, allowing troops to be redirected for the complete liberation and clearing of the Zaporozhye region and Kherson regions, and then onward to Odessa. So, is that the future plan to advance to Odessa? Remember, about a few weeks ago, Gerasimov, the chief of the Russian General Staff, was filmed with a picture of Odessa under Russian control behind him. Is that the plan? Well, Khairulin, in March, described the sequence of events that we've been seeing on the battlefronts with startling accuracy since he wrote them. So if he was right about all of that, perhaps if he was informed in advance about all of that, and I don't know who Khairulin speaks to or who he knows, well then maybe Odessa is also in the Russians' sights. Just saying. Well, on that important point, this is where I'm going to finish my programme today. I've noticed that Angela Merkel, who I consider bears a very large share of responsibility for this crisis in Ukraine and the crisis that we see in Europe, has now given another self-justifying interview, this time to the Hungarian media, in which he's trying to shift some of the responsibility onto the Poles and the Baltic states. I will come to that in my next programme. And of course, we've also had threatening words from the President of the United States, which reinforce my very strong view that another conflict with Iran is coming. But this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.